Spending time online has become an everyday activity for most of us, and I think that means that keeping your personal data safe needs to be a priority, frankly. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I think we have a very useful show for you today. The folks at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection work real hard to keep you and I safe from fraud, identity theft, and a whole lot more. And today, as always, they have some great information to share. Sandy Chalmers is the administrator of the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Sandy, thanks for coming by.
Good morning, Larry.
Appreciate having you here. And Michelle Reinen. Michelle is director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection. It's always great to have you as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Larry.
Well, we'll start talking a little bit. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in, by the way. So if you have a question or comment as we talk about data privacy or consumer fraud, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. How do you make sure that your personal data are safe? Or maybe you need some advice on that. Certainly, Michelle and Sandy are happy to help. And Data Privacy Day. There's a Data Privacy Day. Did you know that? Well, of course you'd know that. It's January 28th. And what's the significance here? Why do we have it on that day? And when you talk about data privacy, what are we after here?
Well, it's an annual international day of awareness that the purpose is to get consumers thinking about how they use the internet, what kind of details, what kind of personal information they're sharing online, and then the steps they're taking to protect their personal information. And a number of information-geared businesses sponsor this event. We're involved. There are a number of federal agencies involved. So it's an opportunity for people to just take a minute and think about how they're using the internet, what they're doing to protect themselves. A couple of general tips. There are a number of ways to look at this, but a couple of general tips. Remember, when you use social media, that what you post can last a lifetime. And in, you know, my observation, what I see is that the most young users of social media and the older users of social media are the ones who share most freely. So I don't know if that's on purpose or what, but before posting online, think about how what you post might be perceived now and in the future and who might see it. Second, own your online presence. Take the initiative to set the privacy and security settings on web services and social media on all your devices to whatever your comfort level is for information sharing. And remember that it's okay to limit how and with whom you share information. And there's a golden rule that also applies to social media posting. Post only about others as you have them post about you. So remember that golden rule applies online as well.
Very, very good tips. As you think about the security threats, I suppose a lot of information can be just picked up from what you're posting, and is that the real threat, Michelle, or is it?
Well, it's your data footprint. So identity thieves are very good about piecing together information from many different sources and putting together a data profile about you, and then performing or executing identity theft and taking over. So you have to be aware of all the different sites. You might piece one little piece of information over here and another over there and one over here, and someone's out there putting it all together and figuring out who you are and a lot of information about you that you don't share all in one place. So that's your data footprint, and you need to keep tabs on it.
And you mentioned identity theft, and I guess that is really on the rise now, Sandy?
Yes, it is. And probably because there are so many ways for identity thieves to get a hold of your personal information and put together pieces, as Michelle said. One one way they have is through sending emails or texts imploring you to take quick action for some reason.
Yeah.
An identity thief can pose as your bank or Medicare or the IRS and use that as a ruse to get personal information from you. So we recommend never providing personal information in response to an email, text, or unsolicited phone call.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And this, you know, now I was just thinking about taxes. You know, I've got, usually I think by the end of January, all the agencies or whatever are required to have their information to each of us. So I'm thinking ahead and thinking, I've got that that I'd like to get done early because I think I'm going to have a little money coming back. But I imagine there's some things just to keep in mind with tax identity. You could have some theft there, too, I would guess.
Yeah, the 1099s are hitting mailboxes right now, and W-2s will be following soon after. Do what you can to pick up your mail quickly. Criminals know that mailboxes are ripe with information right now. But as far as tax ID theft, you know, this has become a huge problem in this country over the past 2 or 3 years. And there's, again, a number of ways that these thieves get information from you. We recommend that you file your taxes early in the season to get a jump on any potential criminal activity. If you file by mail, take your envelope to the post office. Don't leave it in your mailbox. And if somebody claims to be from the IRS and they call you and ask you for your Social Security number or for a payment, ignore that call. That's a really common a crime right now.
Very good points. And we did have someone online. We just lost that person. So let's give you a chance to join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions or comments. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. You know, here's a Facebook question. Let's take that right now from Peggy. Despite the fact that I have been put on, or I am on, the no-call list, I've been receiving robocalls trying to sell me everything from an FDA-approved pain cream to an additive for my septic tank, which is quite a range of calls. Where can I go to report these, or should she be reporting them, Michelle?
Yeah, if she's on the no-call list, then she should definitely report that she's receiving calls. And you can call our 800 number and fill out a complaint form, 1-800-422-7128. Or you can go online and file your complaint online 24/7 if that's easier than having one mailed out to you. But that's datcp.wi.gov. So the initials of our department, Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, .wi.gov. Either place, you know, fill out that complaint form, and we'll follow up with those complaints and see if we can identify who's making the calls and make sure that they're following the law. A lot of times with some of these robocalls, they're international, and we have to work with our partners from other states in the nation to see if we can tag back who's doing it, because they're just plain criminals in some cases making these calls. And that's where we really encourage that. Just hang up. Don't push any buttons. Don't engage in any conversation. Just hang up or don't answer.
There's one other thing I want to go. Now we have lots of calls, and we'll get to those in just a second. But there's one other thing I wanted to bring up having to do with the new year and New Year's resolutions, because I know that one resolution that often comes up is, all right, I'm going to go to a fitness center, get on my weight loss program. What about avoiding scams and frauds in those kinds of situations? Any comments there, Michelle?
Well, sure. One thing you want to do is make sure you take a tour of the facility and know what it is your membership's going to buy you. What services does that include? If there's tanning, if there's food service, just know exactly what it is you're purchasing and get it in writing. And the other thing we really encourage is that you check it out ahead of time with us if you're going to be paying up front for a partial membership, 3 months, 6 months, the whole year, that exceeds the $100, and check to make sure that the company has security on file. Under the law, these fitness centers are required to do that if they take the money up front. So call that 800 number and see if we have that security on file. Otherwise, make sure you're just paying monthly. Contracts shouldn't exceed 2 years. So if you encounter something like that, give us a call and let us know what's going on out there.
All right. Good tips. Larry in Dubuque, Iowa has something. Let's go to Larry. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to make a comment about the scams and calls that you guys were kind of talking about earlier.
Yeah.
I've been repeatedly called before, and thankfully they've stopped now, but there was this guy claiming to be from my bank, and I bank out of state from where I'm from originally, so I do stuff online, and he would always give a speech about this would be recorded for training purposes and stuff like that. But when I asked him his name or employee number, or the address of his facility, he would never give it to me. And eventually I did just stop doing anything. I would just not answer the calls anymore. But red flags kind of went up in my mind. And whenever I called my actual bank, they always said, no, everything's fine with your account. So it's tough because they sound so much like the actual employees. It's hard to make the difference sometimes.
Yeah, that's very good points he's raising there, Sandy.
Yeah, unfortunately that happens a lot. And these callers will claim to be from your bank or from the IRS or from Medicare. And they'll do anything to get you to take quick action to hand over personal information. So what we recommend is that you not respond. If there's any question in your mind about whether the call is legitimate, call a contact number that you have on the back of your credit card or something that came with documentation from Medicare or the IRS, but don't respond directly to these calls. This kind of fraud is just rampant, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Larry, for calling. Let's give Howard and Bruce a chance to join in. Howard, hi.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I wonder if they would talk a little bit about cloud storage. How secure is information that's stored in the cloud and when the cloud is used to transfer data?
Yeah, that's something that's on a lot of people's minds. Have you guys looked into that much yet? Or
That's something that we don't have direct jurisdiction over. General advice to consumers would be to read the privacy policies very carefully before you use a cloud service. Be careful about the type of information you put on the cloud, knowing that it's accessible, and we saw that with the movie stars who had, photos
up on the cloud.
Yeah. But that's as far as we can. We don't have any laws specifically that cover that area.
Okay, so there's no other agency that does either, that's to your knowledge. No. Okay. So that's probably will be someday. So all those movie stars had those photos up on the cloud. And so somebody was able to figure out how to get to them. And, well, I don't have any embarrassing photos, so I guess I'm...
Well, that's good.
in the cloud or otherwise, so I guess I'm safe. But, Howard, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Harry and Madison, your turn. Hi, Harry.
Yes. Hi, Larry. Thank you. And thanks to your guests.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very dissatisfied with the state of affairs regarding protection of the public as far as cybersecurity is concerned. I don't think the governmental agencies are doing enough to pass laws to devise organizations to find these people who are just sitting around trying to steal people's identity and their reputation and their money. these are crimes just as people break into your houses. And a lot of people don't have the expertise and even in the techniques or the skills to protect themselves. I think there should be laws and should the way things are ballooning, I think there should be a whole governmental agency to deal with this thing because we're going into millions and millions of dollars being stolen by these people.
Well, I thank you very much for calling, and let's get some comments from Sandy and Michelle.
Well, a couple of points. First of all, a lot of the prosecution of cases of the type he's talking about happens at the federal level. And the Federal Trade Commission has been extremely aggressive in prosecuting cases against companies and individuals, for example, that collect data for one purpose and then sell it on for another purpose. And there was just a case recently that they prosecuted against a company that was collecting information from ABC type apps that a young child would use, and gathering that data and using it for a purpose other than what was represented. But otherwise, generally, I would say that cybersecurity and data protection is really a shared responsibility. And as a consumer, you also have a responsibility to pay attention to your digital footprint and set your settings the way you want them set. And protect your information as if it were cash.
Yeah, it's... I understand what Harry's talking about. I mean, it really is difficult, and especially if you don't know. And again, I'm thinking a lot of times elderly people are people who aren't just familiar with using all the computers and everything and all the software associated with it. It's something kind of new. I mean, there are kids who just grow up with it, have grown up with it, but then there's others that... are a little naive, let's put it that way, maybe.
True, and you may be involved in doing actions online that you don't understand all the consequences of. One thing as far as your digital footprint goes is posting photos, and now cameras being digital and making sure that you can, they have Wi-Fi services to the camera and stuff, you can end up putting a tag on it, a geographical location. GPS is on your camera. So you end up putting information behind the digital image of your photograph and post that on Facebook or Instagram, wherever you're posting the picture, and someone can look at that photo and figure out where it was taken place. That's called geotagging. And so people can put together a profile, and you may not understand that technology is behind that simple picture. And so here you're getting ahead of yourself, in essence, and giving out information. So you just have to be cautious and that shared responsibility, know what you're doing with technology, and try and protect yourself by removing some of the extra services we keep getting with this new technology to protect yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Harry, thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Do you think you've been the victim of a scam, or did you maybe narrowly avoid one? Love to have you share your stories with us at, again, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at consumer scams today. And this is Data Privacy Day coming up, so we're kind of talking about that as well with our two guests, Sandy Chalmers and Michelle Reinen from the Bureau of Consumer Protection in our Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Thank you for joining in, and our lines are filled now. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for that. Kenneth in Janesville, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I was wondering how long does the history go back for Wisconsin's consumer protection law. I think it was one of the first in the country. But when was this law first on the books?
Yeah. Interesting question, Ken. Thank you. Sandy, you know your history a little bit or not?
A little bit, yeah. It goes back to before Wisconsin was even a state.
Oh,
the
you're kidding.
The territorial legislature enacted a weights and measures law to help ensure that commerce functioned, you know, with some accuracy to make sure a bushel was a bushel and a pound was a pound. And then one of the first laws related to consumer protection dealt with hawkers and peddlers.
Ah.
And they paid a license fee depending on how many horses pulled their wagons.
Oh.
So, but the two really foundational laws of consumer protection in the state deal with fair and honest business practices, and they were both passed at the beginning of the 20th century. One is a law prohibiting fraudulent advertising, and the other is a law requiring that business practices be fair in the state. So those are kind of the two cornerstones of business practices in the state, and consumer protection, of course, is closely tied to those two laws.
Wow. You do know your history.
Just a little.
Anything to add to that, Michelle?
And the only thing we can add is I think then in the 70s, the agency started passing a lot of the administrative codes and rules that we know as landlord-tenant, home improvement, auto repair, the individual subject matter things that came about as the result of the two bigger laws that Sandy talked about, that we have that ability to look at individual industries to make sure that marketplace is balanced.
I'm glad you brought that up. But I had that in my head, but I couldn't remember the years or
the consumer
era.
In the 70s, yeah.
So it was the 70s. So there you go, Ken. Thanks a lot. It was a good question. It was an interesting, I learned something here myself as I listened to these two bright people. Brian and Madison, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Say, I've had a series of calls over the last, 5-10 years, and it's always the sheriff's department with a fund for kids looking for money, or sometimes it's the fire department looking for money for kids. It's always for kids, and you know they sound very professional and stuff, but they're soliciting money for some type of charitable, charitable donation. And it seems to me that these are also fraudulent calls. Have you had any experience with that?
Yeah,
Sandy?
We've had lots of questions about those types of fundraising calls over the years. And you do have to be careful about them and ask a lot of questions. Sometimes they are professional fundraisers who are affiliated with a local sheriff's or fire department, and sometimes they're not. So those are questions that you should ask, and don't assume that anything you give will be used locally. That can be an issue as well.
And the percentage, I've asked that question, and what percentage actually goes to the charity, and usually there's a long pause.
Right. You can always ask to have information mailed to your home, but a couple of things that we mentioned before the holidays, because a lot of these calls are made then, make sure the charity is registered with the State Department of Financial Institutions. If it's not registered, it probably is fraudulent. And just resist that emotional appeal for giving, because that's how they make money, by pressuring you to make a quick decision. So do resist.
I have asked to have the information sent to me, and that's where they try to get you to give a commitment of money.
Yeah.
And that's what makes me think these are not legitimate, because they should be able to send you a flyer or something like that. I've never gotten anything in the mail, and I typically I'm very reluctant to give any money for someone over the phone. I really don't do that, but we get these calls fairly frequently.
And these can't be eliminated through the do not call list, or can they, Sandy?
The do not call law only applies to business solicitations, so no, charities are not covered by that law. You can always ask them not to call you back, but if it is a fraudulent operation of some kind, they'll probably keep calling.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I really don't give anything over the phone either, and I don't think I've ever gotten. I've the same as our caller when I've said, "Well, send me some information, then I'll make up my mind." And then they try to get you to commit. And I said, "Well, no, I'm just not going to commit. So send me something," and I never get anything. So there you go. Wanda in Milwaukee, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Actually, good morning. I had a really, it was a strange call. I don't know if any of your listeners have had this, but on December 23rd, I had somebody call me and say, hey, you cut me off in traffic in downtown Milwaukee. And I said, okay. And then he said, I got your license plate, and I called the DMV, and they gave me your phone number. And I know that's impossible. And so I just said, well, I don't think that's possible. Plus, turns out I wasn't even driving that day. And he said, yeah, you have to give me your insurance information because you cut me off and I almost got in an accident. So I didn't give him any information. And then he just, the gentleman who all just started being very belligerent and just verbally abusive. So eventually hung up the phone. But I just thought, I posted it on Facebook with the phone number that he called me from, and it was a disposable cell phone, and so we weren't able to track it, but I was just very surprised that something like that happened, and I really don't know what the end purpose of the caller was.
So if he was after your insurance information, maybe to file a claim in your name and collect the money at a different address.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that.
Well, that's a guess. I don't know. Michelle, am I even close?
I think you could be onto something there. I can't say I've heard of this variety of it, but we've seen over the last few years some very aggressive phone call scams where there are threats to warrants and out for you, and we're going to put you in jail because unless you respond and you owe this money and wire it to us, or where they're able to say, meet me in the Walmart parking lot and pay this. We know what your house looks like. We're going to send somebody there, and they bring up your address on Google Maps and can describe what color it is and different things. So being able to figure out what road she might be on because of where she lives and being able to do reverse phone lookups and piece together some of that information and put some scare tactic into things to get personal information or money out of you so they can maybe do an insurance fraud in this case.
Oh, yeah. My God, that's insane. I kind of figured it was false because, first of all, I don't think the DMV is even allowed to give out phone numbers.
Right.
And the second thing is he never once used my name. He did not describe my car. So I was like, yeah, this kind of, well, plus it just sounded phony, but well, I was just interested in everybody.
Well, yeah. I'm glad you called to share that because it could happen to somebody else. So now anybody listening will know.
Right. And in a situation like that, okay, where's the police report that's filed for the insurance claim? And same with a warrant, where's the police report or the court order for the warrant? There are legitimate means of real crime happening that you track.
Thanks, Wanda.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate the call. And Ron in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. The reason I'm calling is for a Microsoft scam that I was the recipient of a couple months ago. I was able to thwart the scam, but the truth of the matter is they had all my information. They had my name, my address, my email address, and I was to let them in on my computer, and then they would correct all these problems which I was supposed to have had. Well, I was having problems with my computer at that time. So I immediately contacted a computer company here in town. And they went through my computer to be sure it was safe and make sure they couldn't get access. But they were able to put a couple of viruses on my computer. And so one thing that the public should be aware of, that Microsoft will never contact a client because they don't have that information. Regardless what they say, Microsoft doesn't have that information. They have your license information, but that's all they have.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for calling. Sandy, comment?
Yeah, that Microsoft tech support scam has just become an epidemic, and the Federal Trade Commission has taken down a couple of operations. But still, there are apparently many, many others operating that use this particular pitch. So if you do get one of these calls, remember that Microsoft does not call people and tell them they have problems with their computers. That just does not happen. Anytime you get a call like this imploring you to take immediate action, that's a real red flag. And remember, they can say they're just about anyone, and they do say they're about it just about anyone. But this particular scam has really become very, very common. And we heard recently from our federal partners that this is a scam that has now moved to specifically targeting the elderly. So I would ask that if you have elderly friends, make sure they know about this, and they can almost expect a call from somebody saying they're from Microsoft.
Thanks again, Ron, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Terry in Oak Creek a chance to join in. Terry, hello to you.
Hi. I have a scam-related experience. I also have a question. My experience is I had a call one evening from a woman who identified a particular company she was from, and she said, we have been receiving abusive and obscene computer messages from a computer at this residence. Are you a computer user at this residence? Well, I haven't had internet access for several years, so it was impossible for me to have done that. I wish I would have played along a little bit, but instead I said, I don't even have a computer, and she just hung up. So I'm really kind of curious as to where that might have been going.
Wow. Now, have you heard of that one, that one, Sandy?
That could be headed in some kind of ransom attempt, you know. If you don't pay us money, we're going to report you to the FBI. I mean, I've heard that type of thing, but... It was obviously fraudulent since she hung up once you questioned her.
Well, the fact that he didn't even have a computer, right away, that a little bit of a clue.
But there are several scams like that where they use very threatening tactics, and sometimes they say they're from a local court, a local court official, saying you didn't show up for jury duty and you have to pay us this amount of money right now or we're going to arrest you. You know, it just goes on and on, but they can be very aggressive and threatening.
Hmm. Thanks, Terry, for calling. Sandy at Oconomowoc, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. I have two brief questions and then just one comment. The first question is, if you are accessing the internet and you go into tools and you choose safety and you decide and you choose in private browsing, does that in fact provide you any more security than just not doing that?
It's my understanding that it helps with the tracking and the cache and the cookie aspect of it, but you doesn't help with, you know, what you do in post out there that way. It's the reverse aspect of it and the collection of information about you from the data miners, like where you browse.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
The second one was, when you receive emails and you want to identify them as junk, and you go to that option, it'll say you can add the sender to a blocked senders list, or you can add the sender's domain to a blocked senders list. Is there a distinction there? Should you always choose the sender's domain?
Hmm. I'm not sure. I've never done that, actually, to be honest.
I don't know exactly how the block sender works. So, for instance, if somebody says they're from the IRS but they're not, you have to be careful about people claiming to be other than who they say they are. But the domain, I can see a lot of the junk email comes from Malaysia or Turkey, and you know, so that might be helpful to you unless you regularly want to get email from those countries.
You guys also told me or here a few months back that if you get an email or you're, let's say, going to some place that you think is supposedly secure, that if you hover your arrow over the name, the address, that you'll get some information. And what I typically get is like valid as tested by such and such an agency, and then supposedly you know that it's okay.
Yeah, the hover, you want it to match, not be something different. Mm-hmm. So yeah. It's another tool you can use, you know, watching for the HTTPS when you're doing secure transactions, changing passwords, paying money, doing the hover when you put in a site or click on a link to make sure it matches where you think you are versus something else coming up.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a brief comment, too. And
sure.
This last year, I would say... I've gotten so many emails that have been fraudulent, and they always have, they want you to click on a website, of course, you know. So, boy, oh, boy, it isn't going away anytime soon. I guess it's getting worse. And the scary ones are the ones that come in under the name of someone you know. With an attachment saying, oh, hi, gosh, I haven't seen you. Boy, will you love this website.
Gotten those too.
Not the person you know, it's someone else. So those are the scary ones, and you really got to check those out.
Absolutely right about that. Thank you so much. It's a good reminder, Sandy. Appreciate your call. We're talking data privacy and scams with Sandy Chalmers and Michelle Reinen of the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking consumer protection issues with Sandy Chalmers and Michelle Reinen of the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Great to have them along. Thank you so much for listening in. One or two open lines you can get in at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question or maybe a personal story to relate to us, love to hear from you. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Sue emailed and said, I get credit card applications in the mail on a weekly basis from one bank in particular. I'm careful in disposing of the parts of the mailing that contain any identifying information. Is there a way to put an end to these mailings altogether? Michelle?
Sure. One thing that she may want to do is go to optoutprescreen.com and sign up so she can stop receiving junk mail from junk credit card offers. Mm-hmm. You can also call if you want, and the number is 1-888-5-OPT-OUT, and that O-P-T, O-U-T. Okay. That's one way to reduce those credit card offers and minimize the amount that you get there.
And again, the online, what's the address?
optoutprescreen.com.
Optoutprescreen, obviously all one word. Opt out. I'm going to write this down myself. Prescreen.com. All right. So I can mention it again, and maybe Judith can put it up on our Facebook page, too, at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'll try to get that up, optoutprescreen.com. Michael in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Larry?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm actually just calling with some insight from one of the previous callers concerning the question with her email about blocking the sender versus blocking the domain of the sender. The difference is that blocking the sender only blocks blocked emails from that one particular email address. If you block the domain, it's not domain as in geographic region. What it blocks is the, like, an email address is blah, blah, at whatever.com, so at yahoo.com, say, and if you block the domain, it would block or send all emails from the at whatever part to the junk list. So if you block the domain from an email at yahoo.com, it would, in the future, send all emails from a Yahoo email address to your junk folder.
Oh, okay.
So if it's a odd domain or a seemingly fraud, you can look at the email address and see what the domain is. And if it seems fishy or fraudulent or just like junk, if you block that domain, that would prevent future emails from email addresses originating there.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And Sandy's nodding yes.
That's a really good explanation. Yeah, from somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks again, Michael. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great day.
And we will turn to Jody and De Pere next. Hi, Jody.
Yes. My question is, how risky is it to enter your Social Security number on a secure website? For instance, when you're applying for credit cards or insurance and the like?
Yeah, it's one of those you just hate to have to write that number. But how secure is it? If they want to get it, they're going to get it.
We're all taking deep breaths here. True, if they want to get it, they're going to get it. But it's kind of a loaded question to me. How secure is your computer? How up-to-date is your antivirus software? Do you have a firewall? Are you on a public site? There's a lot that goes into that question. So making sure that you are working on a very secure system, then making sure you're on a secure website and that you're actually at that company's business website, not an imposter website, and that you really want that card, then putting it in after you've read their privacy policy and know that they're doing well. So you have to feel very comfortable and confident in all those layers in order to feel that it's going to be secure.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have more emails, too. What State Department regulates cemeteries? I'd like to find out whether a cemetery burial plot ownership records are audited for completeness and accuracy. A cemetery burial plots, sometimes they're owned by church, they may be owned by a church. Sometimes they're owned by the local municipality. I expect it depends a little bit on who owns them.
You know, without our handy-dandy reference guide in front of us, which is a very thick book, my suggestion is to either call our 800 number, and they will give you a referral phone number to the state agency, 1-800-422-7128, or go on our website, and it's called the Ready Reference Guide, and you can look it up by topic yourself, funerals or cemeteries, and it'll give you the referral information 24/7. And so that website, again, is datcp.wi.gov. And that book's out there for, 24/7. We'll have an updated version near the end of the month, but the data is pretty accurate. We just, make sure we're keeping it up to date regularly, but you can look things up by topic all the time and figure out where you need to go for services.
Very, very good. We had an email from Meredith in Kenosha. This is kind of like an earlier story. She says, my boyfriend had somebody call him around Christmas time, and the man on the other end angrily accused the boyfriend of scratching his car in a parking lot and leaving a note. He insisted my boyfriend give him his insurance information for the damage. Boyfriend told the man he had the wrong number and that he hadn't been in Milwaukee recently and hung up. It was from a Milwaukee number he'd never been called by before. They must be guessing at phone numbers or finding them online or something.
Yeah, that's very similar to the earlier story we heard. I'm making a note of this to do some follow-up. We may need to put out some kind of alert to people in southeast Wisconsin, letting them know this is an ongoing scam.
Yeah, that's very good points. Kristen in Mauston, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I just wanted to share a scam that has recently come up on my cell phone. I had a lady call me three times and tell me that a friend of mine needed to call the plaintiff or they were going to be served at their work or home in Milwaukee, which is where my friend lives. And finally, I called the 800 number that they gave me with the case number, and they answered the phone, and I couldn't understand what company they called or said. And when a person finally came on, I'm like, what company is this? And they said, well, didn't you hear it at the beginning of your call? And I said, no. And I'm like, who are you and why are you calling me? So I gave them the number, and they said it was about fraud charges. And they said that, well, your name was given because you live with this person in Milwaukee. I said, I don't live with that person. And they also called another friend of his with the same numbers, account numbers and whatever. And I did a reverse lookup on the 800 number, and it was RH Group out of New York. And it was a complete scam.
Yeah. Wow.
And I don't know what they're looking for in a plaintiff and why they wouldn't tell me the name of the company that I missed at the beginning of the call.
Yeah, if they're not going to tell you the company at the beginning of a call, you know, that's the signal to hang up right away, I would think, Sandy.
Yeah.
I wanted to get as much information as possible. But
That's true, but...
Yeah, some of these fraudulent calls will use kind of vague references to court actions or court dates, or they'll throw around legal terms in in an effort to make themselves sound more legitimate or more scary. I think in the future you can just ignore these calls.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for calling. Email from Bill says, there's a notion on the internet, if you start your phone answering machine with those three tones, which indicate a disconnected phone, a robocall software recognizes it and removes you from their list. You can find the tones on the internet. Does that really work?
I think we've had an email or another caller suggest those different methods before, and I can't say I've tried it or know either way if it works. So it's potentially another tool if you want to start your machine that way. It probably doesn't hurt to try.
Yeah, I guess so. It would be quite a shock. It might be a shock to your friends or relatives when they call.
People may think you've moved.
But if you're getting inundated with, as some of our callers in the past, like last month when you were on, I was just feeling really bad for a couple of people who were getting like hundreds of calls. I mean, it was unbelievable the number of calls they were getting. I would probably resort to something like that if I was in that shape. Anne in West Bend, your turn. Thanks, Anne.
Yeah, I have a question about that annual credit report.
Yeah.
Now, if I order from one of the companies within a calendar year, I can order from each of the others. My question does that run now, say, for 2015? If I haven't ordered from, say, Equifax since July of 2014, am I allowed now to order it again in January? Or do I have to wait a full 12 months before I can order again from Equifax? Because I've tried to order one, and it says I already have, and I have not.
Hmm. I I wonder if there's a customer service number you could call and ask that question. I had assumed it was on a calendar year basis, but maybe if you were denied, it's every 12 months.
Yeah. I thought
yeah,
it was
made
not.
Me kind of nervous because it said two of them I already had ordered and I had not. So now I put in for a paper credit report.
Or did it say you had ordered or was somebody else maybe like a bank or something?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. And I asked my bank and they said they wouldn't order it unless I was looking for a loan of some kind.
Yeah, and you you haven't been looking for a loan or a refinance or anything?
Yeah, and I wouldn't be in that kind of position at all. So I'm wondering if somebody else is ordering it and I'm not aware of it.
Well, other people can order it, can't they? Without your, I mean, I'm trying to remember the last time I had to get a home loan or something.
The ones that, like, a business orders is different than the one that the consumer is entitled to once a year.
Oh, okay.
So you, as the consumer, are entitled to your review. What the other one starts to show your score, and it's for evaluation of extension of credit. Anna, I would suggest that you file a complaint with our agency so we can contact the two companies you've been denied, and we'd get their official response. And it might just be that it's on a 12-month, basis as opposed to calendar years, and then it'll help educate us as well that that's the way that those companies operate, that there may be a requirement they only have to give it every 365 days versus calendar year, but that also maybe there's something else going on there. So I'd encourage you to file a complaint with us, and that's 1-800-422-7128.
1-800-422-7128, or go to DATCP.WI.gov. We're going to take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guest. Stay with us. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. In the course of an average week or month, you act as a consumer many, many, many times, so it's easy to not be vigilant about monthly bills and everyday interactions. And that's where problems can develop, and scam artists can get in there and raise some heck with your finances or worse. Michelle Reinen, Director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection, one of our guests today. Michelle, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
And Sandy Chalmers, the Administrator of the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Thank you for joining us, Sandy. Appreciate
nice to
it
be with you.
We had a call from Ahmed earlier, and he was... He had additional questions, I guess, that we didn't cover. And I think probably the best thing for him to do is to call your number and talk to somebody directly. And at least that's what I guess I'd recommend, Sandy.
Sure. He can call our toll-free hotline number. It's 1-800-422-7128. And if you have questions about a complicated situation, we have people there in the office during regular office hours who are happy to walk you through specific scenarios or answer questions.
Okay. So again, it's 1-800-422-7128. All righty. Esther in Deer Park, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon, I guess it is. I received a phone call this morning saying that it was a company called Artemis and that they were going to file a lawsuit against me. Said it was my final notice. I'd never heard from them before. I copied down the number, and then I hung up, and I called the sheriff's department, but I haven't been able to talk to them yet because there was no one on duty to take my call. Is this something that has come up before with your organization, or what information can I find out about that?
Yeah, we've heard lots of variations on that robocall. I can't think of any specifically mentioning that company name, but of course these scams evolve all the time. Do file a complaint with us. You can do that by going online at datcp.wi.gov or call the toll-free number we just mentioned, 800-422-7128.
All right, I have that. Thank you. I have a question. If someone was going to file a lawsuit against you, wouldn't you receive papers in the mail or get a summons or
yes.
something?
Yes, you certainly would. Yeah. And as we've mentioned with some of these other threatening calls, they tend to throw around legal terms and make it sound imperative that you take immediate action, you know, and that's just a tactic they use that is probably works very well for them.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm. It was the number 206. Is that a United States area code or is that out of the country?
206.
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
It's not Washington D.C. area, is it, or the East
Coast?
That's
202.
Oh, that's 202.
But remember, you can't trust your caller ID. Software is available that criminals use all the time that can make your caller ID say whatever they want it to say. So
this was the robocall had stated this number, and I copied it down.
Yeah,
but I wasn't going to call it. I just was.
Yeah, I would file a complaint.
Yeah, be sure to include the phone number information in the complaint because it could help us piece different calls together.
Absolutely.
So.
Thanks, Esther, and appreciate your call very much. I want to give Carl, who's in Mexico and calls occasionally, a chance to join in. Hi, Carl. Thanks for calling.
I'm on the only phone that I have available. I hope I'm coming through clearly.
You are.
Okay, great. What I have is some information to share rather than a question.
Okay.
Are you, Larry, or your guests aware that all three of the major credit bureaus of the USA farm out their customer service via telephone to Europe and India? Are you aware? Any of you aware of that?
No.
No.
And I consider it a national security issue, and the government should crack down on that. The credit bureaus should not be allowed to farm out worldwide the customer service. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, anybody worldwide could be tapping into your phone and getting your information while you're talking to these guys. That's one exception to farming out that should never be allowed. I consider it a national security risk.
Oh, something I had not heard about. It says, well, it's worth looking into to see if that, in fact, I guess Carl says it's the case, but we can check and make sure, double check to make sure that it is the case. Thanks, Carl, for calling. Appreciate the call. Sandy, yeah. Comment?
He raises a concerning point, and I would say that the credit bureaus are heavily regulated, but at the federal level, and we have very little involvement with them.
Oh.
So that I
can't
guess
really
the,
do much.
The Consumer Protection Financial Bureau might be a more appropriate place to take a concern like that.
No. Okay, there we go. Thanks, Carl. Vivian in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, and I'm just raising an issue that I haven't heard before, and I don't have a problem any longer. But 14 years ago when my husband passed away, I sold a little geo tracker to a local person who wanted it for his college son. And accidentally, about 2 years later, I learned that the registration with the Department of Transportation had never been updated to his name. It was still in my name. And even though the license plate was different, the VIN number would have always brought that car back to my attention. And I attempted to get the police department and the DOT to help me change that, just in case there was ever an accident or something, and the information would have been old. It would have been me and not the right people. There was no help forthcoming from either of those agencies. But I knew the vehicle because of the substandard paint job that had been done on it.
Uh-huh.
And I saw it parked locally. I went in and talked to the owner. And he didn't even remember that he hadn't changed the registration. But I insisted and told him I would take some other action that I wasn't even sure would amount to anything. But it was finally changed. So I think many of us who sell to a private party cannot rely on that purchaser to follow through and change the information. So they should always do it themselves because there isn't any help in getting it done afterward.
Hmm. Michelle, are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar exactly with the registration process with the DMV. I thought every year they mailed out their registration, and then there was questions as to whether or not you still own the vehicle and boxes you could check if you no longer did and things. So if you have a concern with that, I mean, contacting the Department mm-hmm. of Transportation is the right agency to work through those situations. Mm-hmm. And they may have some guidance online as it relates to personal sale and transfer registrations.
Yeah.
You know what I think? I think they send those notices out based on your license plate, maybe not on your VIN number, because I sure didn't get any notices to renew my license plate on that vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be. Again, I would just work there for the guidance on the sale of personal vehicles and transferring registration. DMV may have some, must have some process procedure for that.
Yeah, that has to have come up before. But thanks for pointing that out, Vivian. It's certainly worth considering and thinking about and making sure that that base gets covered, for sure. Thank you. Bob and Krivitz, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yes, I'm here.
What's on your mind?
Okay. I called in and I spoke with the same lady 2 years ago. Okay, I'm a veteran and I am retired. I'm 68 years old. And I've got a problem here. You know, we're talking about how important it is not to let out the Social Security number. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And on my VA medical card, my veteran's medical card, they only state the last four numbers, okay? So anytime I go to the VA for any of my medical treatments, this is what I use, this card. Anytime I go to a hospital or a doctor in the United States that's not VA, I've got to show them my medical card, my Medicare, okay? Why does that Medicare card have to have all of my numbers on it?
That's a good question. One that I'm sure our guests can't answer because that's not part of their area. But comment anyway, Michelle. I don't understand why. Or Sandy? Sandy,
well,
go ahead.
I think it has to do with money, Larry. And this has been an issue for years. And just imagine moving everybody with a Medicare number to a new numbering system and how much that would cost, not only from the IT perspective, but just issuing new cards and things like that. And I know there are bills introduced in Congress every session to address this, but I think it really has to do with the cost. And what we've recommended in the past is that you make a copy of your Medicare card and block out the first five numbers and carry that with you. And if you're ever in a situation, an emergency situation, surely the emergency room would let you bring the real copy of your Medicare card at a later time. But it is not a good practice to carry your Social Security number with you in your wallet or purse. I mean, that makes it really easy for a criminal to steal your identity.
Well, yeah, that is for sure. I had an interesting thing this morning where it was a government agency kind of thing where I was talking to somebody and I said, I want to verify your address, and the address was an old address. And she said, well, what's the zip code from that address? And I couldn't think of it. I said, I tried a couple different numbers. She said, no, that's not right. No, that's not right. And I said, you need this just to verify it's me? And she said, yeah. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to look it up right now. And I looked it up online and gave her the number. She said, yep, that's the one. And I thought, well, I don't know. How safe is that, that I was able to do that? Oh, we won't go into any more details on that one, but I thought it was kind of funny because I told her exactly what I was doing. I said, I'm just going to call this up on, you know, find your zip code. And I did, and she said, yeah, that's it. Ellen in Madison, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Excellent show. I'm a financial educator here in Madison, and I wanted to clear up some of the confusion about the annualcreditreport.com.
Yes.
And yes. annualcreditreport.com. As your listener said, you can get each of your three credit reports, no score, and it's not the calendar year. It's from the time that you have pulled that report through that year, 365 days, you can pull it again. So that it is not calendar year. It is from the date that it's pulled.
Okay.
And that's clear. And yes, banks can look as well, but it has nothing to do with annualcreditreport.com. Anyone else accessing it, that's for the consumer to access their report.
Okay, so if this person was supposedly there were people accessing the reports, that'd be a cause for concern then, wouldn't it?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
One of the things that you look at when you get your report is what's called the inquiry. And part of why we get the credit reports now is so we can see everyone who's looking at our report. So when she applies for credit or a cell phone or anything like that, that's going to show. But also any promotional inquiries. So, for instance, if one of the credit card companies is going to send a pre-approval, they're looking at the credit reports of those people first.
Okay.
So it'll show everybody who's looked, and that's one of the important things to look at on a credit report.
Excellent. Good information, Ellen. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it. So it's not the calendar year. It's from the time the person first requests. Yeah, there we go. John in Waukesha, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say a follow-up comment on the earlier topic of the selling a vehicle to a private party and the seller not, you know, registering and titling or ensuring that was done by the buyer.
Yeah.
I'm in law enforcement, and while it's not real common, it has happened numerous times over the years where people have done that, and the car ends up either being illegally parked or abandoned somewhere, and they find themselves with unpaid parking tickets that, you know, they're still coming back as the owner. They find themselves with even driver suspensions for failing to pay those tickets, court cases. And this just can go on, and every time to resolve it, it can be resolved, but it's a lot of hassle. And then also those vehicles could be used in a commission of a crime.
Oh.
So it's another thing where you don't want to leave the titling and registration fully in the hands of the person that's buying the vehicle. If you're selling it to a private party, you really should go to the DMV and make sure it gets done right in front of you when you sell it. And that would avoid that, because it has happened to people, and it's a big mess to clean up.
Oh, boy, John, thank you so much. That's you've given some good information here, and I think there'll be some practices changed.
Yeah, that makes it easier for us, too, when it's
sure.
Those are problems that don't need to happen in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. John, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. Well, that was another good, useful call, wasn't it? So we know a little bit more about that. And when you sell privately, I haven't done that in a long time. I can't remember. I think the last few times I've traded my car in to the dealer where, you know, and of course in those situations, I can't imagine there being a problem there, unless maybe it was some fly-by-night dealership.
Yeah, the things we typically hear about with respect to car sales in our legal jurisdiction are when people post vehicles or boats online on website classifieds and they hear from fraudulent buyers.
Oh, yeah, sure. Let's see. We've got some emails I wanted to... Bill, do you think there is any hope that there will be laws that would require phone companies to offer the option to block robocalls? I suppose depends on technology.
Some federal laws come into play there, but many phones now have an option to block calls by area code or
phone companies will let you enter a command star and some combination of digits to block further calls from that number. So there are, and I know the Federal Trade Commission is working with private industry to come up with solutions on that. So, but he's right that it will have to be at some kind of technological solution.
Boy, here's one from Ginny. I got a call from a previous bank that I did business with, and it was from that bank last night telling me that someone was using my name, Social Security number, and date of birth to successfully obtain online banking access. Because I have no active accounts in that bank, they were unable to do anything with the account. I have put a fraud alert on my information with the three major credit agencies. How concerned should I be that someone has my name, Social Security number, and date of birth? What can I do to safeguard my existing bank accounts? I'm sure she's already contacted her current bank. But even then, if they've got all that information, what do you think, Michelle?
Well, there's lots of layers of things that can be done. First, instead of a fraud alert, I'd probably, if you're in a position to do so, put a security freeze on your credit reports. And a fraud alert notifies you when someone wants to take an extension of credit, whereas a security freeze locks it down, and then you can't take an extension of credit. Do exactly what you said, Larry. Contact your active bank right now and make sure that you have any security measures they have in place for you, two-factor verification if she banks online, so there's double password protection or double protection there. Accessing your credit reports and checking those to monitor the activity and see if there's anything funny going on there, and then contacting our agency if she sees any of these things for correction, undoing. We can assist with that and any other prevention that we can provide. Those are the initial three things. So 1-800-422-7128, so we can have someone from our Office of Privacy Protection within the Consumer Protection Program assist with the potential for identity theft there.
Boy, that was that is a scary one. Oh, my goodness me. Because if somebody can get... We actually did have someone call once and say that somebody had gotten into her account and cleaned everything out, including she had like $3,000 or something on it that you could, like, sort of credit card, that they had maxed that out too.
Right.
So she lost everything, plus she owed another $3,000.
Yeah, that's why contacting that bank right away, because they may have extra security measures for victims of identity theft there that they can put in place, making sure you have to show your ID, banking online measures, beyond the regular good practices that are in place for everybody.
Boy, boy, oh boy. Well, and here we are with about 30 seconds to go. In 30 seconds, any last final thing, Sandy, you want to remind folks about? Or
Be really proactive in keeping track of the latest scams. And you can, one thing you can do is follow us on Facebook at WI Consumer, and we post the latest things we're hearing from Wisconsin consumers about the calls they're getting, the fraudulent charges that are showing up on their credit cards, and really take control of what you can.
And again, that number, if you want to file a complaint or for more information, it's 1-800-422-7128. Or go online to the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection online service at datcp.wi.gov. And Judith, in her usual efficient self, has already got that posted up on our Facebook page, too. So you can get all that information at our Facebook page, which is The Larry Mueller Show. Tomorrow, Patty Nagai from UW Extension joins us for another edition of Garden Talk. Thanks for listening. You stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.